Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Billboard Chart Beat Podcast. Terry Trust, Billboard Senior Director of Charts.
Man, hey guys, it's Trevor Anderson, a chart manager here at Billboard.
So we're going to be talking Bad Guy this week on the podcast. Trevor, we were just talking about Bad Guys. Somehow started singing the theme to Cops.
Yeah, it was, she started it. I mean, me and the producer intern that we have here, the stellar Ivana. Randomly, if you're in some film promo, you know that Bad Boys for Life is the third movie in the Bad Boys canon is going to be out next year. So, you know, Bad Boys on the top of mind again.
So Bad Guy is what we're talking about. Billie Eilish, Bad Guy, finally hit number one on the Hot 100, dethroned the all-time longest leading number one, Old Town Road by Lil Nas X featuring Billy Ray Cyrus. Phineas, who Billie Eilish's brother, but also artist, writer, producer in his own right, he co-wrote Bad Guy with Billy, produced the song himself, and, well, we wanted to find out all about it. So we've got our friends, Hit Songs Deconstructed, Dave and Yael Penn, who, they're our most frequent guests on the podcast since we started this back in March 2016. They're back for, I think, their record extending, 12th appearance.
Record extending, he said. I love it.
With Phineas. Phineas is our special guest this week here on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast. So talking everything about Bad Guy, how it was written, how it was produced, certain parts of the song specifically that Dave and Yael are so great about just digging in and going so deep on. So, this podcast is going to be all Phineas and Hit Songs Deconstructed, breaking down Bad Guy and how it became such a big hit. And also Phineas with his own music coming out. He's got his debut EP, Blood Harmony. That's out October 4th. And his own sold-out headline tour, too, kicks off October 15th. So this is really fun. Phineas getting into all things that made Bad Guy a number one Billboard Hot 100 hit with Dave and Yael Penn from Hit Songs Deconstructed on the Billboard Chartbeat podcast. Phineas, welcome to the Billboard Chartbeat podcast.
Thanks for having me, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So we're going to go total deep dive into Bad Guy, how it was written and produced with Dave and Yael. But just wanted to ask you first, first of all, congratulations on hitting number one on the Billboard Hot 100 with Bad Guy. What was your reaction right when you found out? Do you remember exactly finding out that Bad Guy had hit number one?
You know what's funny about it? First of all, I don't know if Billy or I ever thought we'd have a number one song, just because they're always, you know, people that have number one songs are like our musical heroes, you know, and incredibly huge artists. So we were shocked when we were even in contention. And the week that it looked like it was going to go number one, you know, a couple members of our team were like, you know, it's pretty close to number one this week, just so you guys know. And we were like, oh, wow, that's crazy. And then a couple days went by and we were like, hey, did it go number one? And somebody was like misinformed and they're like, yeah, no, Old Town Road is still number one. We were like, well, that's cool, good for him. And then like a day later, someone was like, no, actually it's number one. And we were like, oh my God, that's so crazy. And, you know, I don't know. I felt no competitive nature with Lil Nas. I think he's a sweetheart. And I think that song is incredibly catchy and fun and, couldn't be happier for him and his you know, 37-year run as the number one song on the Billboard Hot 100. So, you know, we just feel grateful to be in such good company.
You said, Phineas, that you just assumed number one songs were by your heroes, but you guys have it. Also surprised in the sense that it's not your typical pop hit. You and Billy have said that this, you guys say, it's you know, it's a little different than your typical pop song. Does that make it also surprising that you got to number one with this specific song?
Yeah, I mean, totally. I think there's a lot of things about this song that when we were making it, we didn't really, we knew that we liked it. We were very, you know, excited about it from a kind of a creative standpoint, really liked listening to it and like writing it. But I think from a commercial standpoint, we were kind of overthinking that and thinking about like, you know, the kind of chorus the song needs to have to be a huge hit song. And I think this song to us just didn't feel like it had the kind of chorus that a traditional hit has. And, you know, I think it's like, I think this song is a really good example of like just a song, like, you know, there's a term earworm, right? It's just like songs that just get stuck in your head. And I think this song probably, you know, the thing that is like the most hooky about it is that it just gets stuck in your head, that you're a tough guy, like a really rough guy, never get enough guy, you know, bar. It's just like super fun to kind of like wrap your mouth around. And I think also like in a weird way, I've noticed this when we do it live, like the crowd just kind of screams that part, you know, they just sort of chant it. And I think like one of the things that that song probably has going for it, which is like a similar thing to like, you know, the way kids sing along to a Drake song, is that like it's kind of like almost a rap in that part. You know what I mean? I don't want to, you know, have people jump down my throat. I don't think this is a rap song, good God. But I do think that, like, you can sing along. You can be not a singer and sing along to Bad Guy because of how rhythmic it is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really important. I think, like, if you write a song with, like, a really complex melody, even if it's a big song, like, people sing it less because people aren't confident in their own voices, you know?
All right, Yael and Dave, get right into what you guys do best. Let's go really deep into Bad Guy. Take it away.
So, hey, Phineas, Yael here. And first of all, congratulations on all the well-deserved success.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So from what I understand, what became Bad Guy's ending is actually what inspired the song to begin with. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it was its own whole thing. I basically walked into Billy's room at some point in like 2017, and I heard like the basics of that beat, like the hi-hat and the 808 kick drum, and she'd been like recording her own vocal for it, I believe. Mm-hmm. And it was the whole kind of last, I don't know how many seconds it is, like 40 seconds of the song. And it was this cool bar. Like, she wrote all the lyrics that outfit. So, like, you think she's scared of me? I don't see what she sees for me because I'm wearing your cologne. That whole thing was just, like, she had written out the stick. And I loved it the first time I heard it. But one of the things I loved about what she'd done is that Billy was just starting out on, like, producing it all. Like, basically the first thing she'd produce. And so she hadn't, like, learned any of the stuff you're supposed to not do in production. Like, it was distorting and flipping. And mm-hmm. and that was what I liked. Like, this sounds really badass. But the part of the problem with flipping and distortion is that because of normalizing and overload detection, a lot of that stuff gets lost when you export it, even if it's just flipping. And it doesn't mm-hmm. quite sound the way it does in the engine. And also, she had her subwoofer and her two Yamaha HS5 speakers on like a vanity set in her room, like where she would keep like, you know, her, you know, I don't even know, like her book. and so the whole outro was like rattling the way that like, you know, speakers can rattle a room. And the rattle was really exciting. Like, I loved the way the rattle sounded. So what I had her do was I had her send me like the 808 and then the hi-hat. And then I I filtered and processed them for a long time to get them to sound as dirty and angry as they, you know, as they possibly could, even at like the lowest volume. That was like my goal. Like even at low volume, it sounds loud.
Yeah.
Like it sounds fierce. And then I added some like off rhythm, trap hats and stuff. And that was just like a cool little 45 second thing that we really liked. And, you know, I just felt really good about it. And then we kind of didn't really know what to do with that. So we just put it on hold. And then I was with her like literally like 7 or 8 months later. And we were in my room just like messing around on stuff. And I played the kick drum bass combo that is like the whole, you know, root of the rest of the song. That like bump, ba-na-na, bump, ba-na-na. I played that on like a synth and it's like a regular like kick drum. Like honestly, I think it was like a Logic Doc preset kick drum. And it just like already worked, sounded really cool.
Uh-huh.
And so we started writing the verses, and the verses existed without us knowing that the song was gonna turn into Bad Guy. We just had this I played like these chords over top of the bass line drum pattern, and playing like the triad felt really cool, and I was playing them at the rhythm that the vocal ended up being, and that was the inspiration for us having the vocal always be like three-part harmony in the verse. And then I'm assuming it was probably Billy's idea to be like, this song should be I'm the Bad Guy, we should use that other part at the end of it. And then I was like, okay, well, now that I know that this song is called I'm the Bad Guy, and then I wrote the whole you're a tough guy, like a really rough guy, just always so tough guy part off of that, and that turned into this hook that I think, you know, everybody sings along to so loud when we do shows. It's the best feeling.
So basically you had what is the ending, and then you were working on what you just described, and then at what point did you know you wanted to put them together then?
I think as soon as we were calling the song Bad Guy, as soon as we had written like the hook of like I'm the Bad Guy, I think we were like, oh, well then they have to go, you know, after each other. But it was definitely like, you know, we definitely had conversations about like are each of the hooks like at the different tempo that this ending is at, or are they not? Like, you know, just we weren't like certain until we like tried everything, which I think is like the best part about like modern production and modern recording, is like you can make an unlimited amount of versions, you know, and so we always kind of try every idea we have, and then we just let the best idea be the best idea. So, you know, to me, I think like, you know, the rest of the song is made really interesting by the outro, and I think the outro is made really interesting by the rest of the song. So like they really, really complement each other.
So what was the writing process like? Were you developing the lyrics and the music concurrently, or was one driving the other? How did that work?
Well, the melody of the verses is very chordal. It's not, there's not a lot of movement in the melody of the verses. It's much more about like the rhythm, that like white shirt, now red top, you know, it's like it's really syncopated.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that Billy and I approached that was we both agreed on that rhythm. We thought the rhythm sounded great. And then we basically just started like pretending the lyrics into existence. Like, just like white shirt, now red thing. And then it was like figuring out the rhymes and figuring out the narrative. And it became really quickly like a song about like someone having like a lot of like bravado, you know, and not really not really being the real deal, and just feeling like, yeah, like you think you're like all this, and really like I don't have to brag about it because I really am that. You know what I mean?
I'm the real deal.
So all the lyrics became that, about like you know that I'm in control, but I can let you pretend that you're in control of this. And you know, we always wanted it to be this like really clipped rhythmic thing, and most of the time we write songs just like on a piano or a guitar, and we just sing them and then we record it later. But in this song's case, we were recording it the whole time we were writing it, which I think was really informative, and really like we knew stuff worked and stuff didn't work right away. And it's funny, like You'd think recording a vocal that's that rhythmic and that syncopated is easier than it is. It's really like a challenge. So we really like worked really hard on making sure the timing of everything was right and like just made it. We wanted it to feel really sharp, which I think is how it feels ultimately.
Oh yeah, definitely. So how long did it take from when you guys actually started working on the song to when you completed it?
You know, the way we work is a kind of a funny thing. We don't usually like, it's not like the set of a movie or a TV show. It's not like every day until it's done. Usually it's like one day where we get a lot done and then we work on other stuff for a while. And then we come back to it another day and we get more done. And then we work on other stuff and then we come back to it another day and maybe it's almost finished. So I would bet that like the total amount of days that we actually worked on the song is like four or five full days, but wow, over the course of like, you know, probably like 7 months, 6 months, 7 months. And then the outro was obviously like mostly written and recorded the summer before that. So it was like a week and a half of work over the course of like a year.
Okay. So, Bad Guy takes you on a bit of a roller coaster ride with twists and turns and some unexpected developments that really puts it in a class of its own. And we'd love to get your take on some of the elements that we found most interesting. What I'll do is turn things over to Hit Songs Deconstructed's chief deconstructor, David Penn.
Oh, that's a title. thank you, Al. Hey, Finis, how are you? So,
how are you?
I'm great. What really sets Bad Guy apart from other recent Hot 100 Top 10 hits, besides the dark, taunting, tongue-in-cheek lyrics, are the unique production qualities and sounds that you brought to it. So let's start at the top of the song and check out the intro. So it kicks off with this killer bass hook, which along with the kick establishes the driving down and dirty vibe. Now layered over it, yep, Billy's fragmented vocals are heard doubling the hook melody, casually floating in and out of the mix. So I'm curious, was there something specific that you were looking to accomplish by having Billy's vocals fragmented in that manner?
Yeah, absolutely. We were accomplishing tone. Sub bass and kick energy often makes the actual key that you're in feel obscure, especially when you're listening to something on an iPhone or
yep,
listening to it on a laptop or listening to it on AirPods. Very yep, hard to distinguish tonality in a sub bass. Basically anything under like 150, 200 hertz, very mm-hmm, hard to distinguish. So we knew that if we had Billy singing along, you'd know exactly what key it's in by the time the vocal came in.
Mm. Gotcha. And what I also like about it is that it also draws attention to the bass hook and helps to define that. I thought that was really clever about that.
Yeah, I mean, the same principle. I think that's the whole goal, is like
exactly,
make it more than a bass hook, make it a thing. And
yep,
and like when we've been like on tour, we've been on tour in Europe for the last, I don't know, month or so. And like
yeah,
the kids in the crowd sing along to the bass line at the beginning of the song. Huh. Like it's like a soccer chant or something. It's the best.
That's cool. Well, that's when you know you have a good hook.
Yeah,
very cool. So speaking of the bass hook, how'd you come up with it? Was it something that you already had in the pocket, or, you know, did it come about more during the writing process?
It feels kind of like a pattern that I might have been just playing whenever I got to like a sub bass on a keyboard, but it's definitely
yeah,
very, like I play it live on a bass guitar and it sounds the same, but on a keyboard it's basically like the chord broken up into notes in a low octave, so
yeah,
it's a really like thin bass line, you know what I mean? Like I don't know if I would have written it if I hadn't been on like a synth bass. And the just a little thing I'll add is that it was this kick bass thing, and the kick and the bass needed to like just sound perfect together,
yeah,
because
yeah,
it was like the only two elements. And so every time we would go to record the vocal, I would be like, wow, this sounds great. And then every time we'd listen back, I'd be like, something's missing. And I realized that the thing that was missing was that I really liked the high end of the metronome on the kick drum. The metronome and the kick are, you know, just four on the floor with every beat.
Yeah.
I love the way the metronome sounds. I recorded the metronome and then put the metronome on the song.
That's cool.
It cuts out whenever the kick drum cuts out, but it's part of the, you know, there's obviously a lot of like low end of the kick, which is like other drums, but one of the parts of the high end is actually the metronome. I caught it, really just helped it cut through. So
that's really interesting.
The built in Logic metronome for that.
Yeah. Oh, very cool. Now, one other thing is that Billy's vocal, along with a minimal reverb and sparse arrangement, makes it, you know, feel really up close and personal, which is, you know, not only indicative of the song, but the album as a whole. So I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that.
I mean, we've evolved the way we approach the treatment of her vocals a lot. And one of the things we wanted to do on this record was never put in a reverb or a delay that didn't have like a purpose to it. A lot of the time in pop music, especially, there's a reverb kind of on the whole vocal of the whole song without much of an explanation. And the reason that is that reverb makes vocals sound better 99% of the time. It just makes them sound more full and more lush and makes the notes ring out. And, you know, I have nothing against reverb, but one of our approaches to this album was to make it feel like you were sitting right next to Billy in our bedroom recording. And also, you know, we did make this whole album in a bedroom. And so I think when you make an album in an environment, you kind of want the album to sound like that environment. And obviously, like, my little bedroom at my parents' house had no reverb, you know what I mean? It wasn't a church or a big hall or anything. So we liked how cut and dry all of the vocals felt, and we just started to embrace it. And you know, there are little, like, there's a lot of, like, when you dry out a vocal, you can make a lot of decisions about the vocal that come in and out that people pay a lot of attention to. Like, I think if there was a lot of reverb on the vocal of this whole song, everybody, like, was really excited about, like, the tremolo effect on, like, the hook vocal, like, when it's behind the bad guy, it kind of sounds like a rattlesnake.
I just feel like
if I had had, like, a bunch of reverb and delay on the rest of the song, that stuff wouldn't be as noticeable, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
So it was all about, like, getting out of, and also, like, you know, one of the things about Billy is the voice just, like, rocks. So I'm never trying to, like, hide her voice from anybody. I just want everybody to, like, I'm like a proud dad. I'm like,
that's awesome.
That's great. So following the intro, Bad Guy then heads into the first verse where the bass hook remains in effect, and then Billy layers in her harmonized staccato vocals. So let's just check that out.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
White shirt, now red, my bloody nose sleeping. You're on your tippy toes creeping around like no one knows. Think you're so criminal. Bruises on both my knees for you. Don't say thank you. Oh, please, I do what I
First of all, that's a killer opening line that really sets the tone of the song. But what I'd love to focus on are some of the more production techniques, like the multi-layered fanned-out snaps and the increasing number of vocal layers, which, along with Billy's limited range and staccato delivery, you know, really provides Bad Guy with a very unique quality. So can you talk a little bit about them and how it helped to create the vibe that you were going for?
From the beginning on, the vocal melody was that I was sitting at a piano playing like a D minor chord with that syncopation. So that ended up being really appealing, was just like sticking with that G minor chord and having the voice do that. And so the kind of lead vocal is playing the center note of that triad. Mm-hmm. And then the harmonies of the low and high, which just makes it up to be this full chord. So if you think about it, the only chord in the song is the vocal. You know what I mean?
True.
Like,
yeah.
There's a bass note and a kick drum, but the only actual chordal center is just what her voice is doing,
mm-hmm.
which was really appealing to me. I'm just the biggest fan of minimalism. So to me, it's like, let's see how long we can keep it just be a kick drum. And then, okay, now we need to do something else. Instead of adding like a huge snare, like let's add like these little like crunchy snaps, like bone breaking sounds that just come in that are really loose. Like they're not super quantized. They're just on each note, which I felt like was really interesting.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think just like leaving the most room for like each lyric to stand out. Like she says criminal. And then I think the next one is my soul so cynical. And I think the beat drops out for a second, and just like anything that we could do to just really like draw as much attention to like her lyrics as possible is really the goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. But what I also like about the snaps is that it really does contribute to that kind of creepy offsetting quality about the song. So, you know, it's like more of like an Addams Family kind of snap thing going on. You know, it was really cool.
Oh, totally. Yeah. No, that was, I was definitely, like, it was just, definitely like the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was great. Cool. So after the verse, you know, we get into what's typically the focal point in every hit. And that's of course the chorus. Now, while Bad Guy's 8-bar chorus is really catchy, you know, what's interesting is that there isn't one particular hook that really stands out in the section. You know, instead, it, like, the chorus takes tension in anticipation to a climax and then sets up that main payoff in the two bars that follow in the turnaround. So I'm just going to play that for a second here.
So cynical. So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy, just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type, make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy. Duh.
So first off, I have to ask, how did the duh come about? Because it really makes for this unforgettable song-defining moment.
You know, I think we always try to inject a sense of humor into our music. And, you know, I think it might have just been a thing we were saying, you know, we had like the whole hook and then there was this like pause and I think we might have just been like, duh, and we thought that was funny. And then of course, like, this is like the whole deal with like any like halfway spoken word thing.
Yeah.
That you're like, well, that'll be easy because I don't have to have like perfect pitch on it. It's just a word. And you say duh like 700 times. And none of them sound natural and none of them sound good.
Right.
So how many takes did it actually take?
Good question.
Oh, so many. I mean, it took an incredibly high number of takes. And, you know, even then, like, you know, we still were like second guessing it so much.
Yeah.
And it's just like one of those funny things, but I really like the delivery that she had a lot. I think it's like, so it's got such good character.
Yeah.
A couple little production, you know, tidbits on that are like, there's a little offbeat kind of shaker hi-hat type thing to try to build momentum. And then there's a plugin I use a lot called Omnisphere. And one of the patches it had sounds like static electricity or like a static breakup. And that's kind of the only like quote unquote riser of the song. Like usually in order to build like tension and relief, like you build like a, a sound that escalates and then de-escalates. And in that song's case, the only thing that really does that is this weird, like this like static electricity sound.
Yeah. Thing. I was wondering about that. Yeah.
And, and also like, I like the idea of having a piece that like maybe tricked out listeners and they were like, ooh, I wonder if there's like a glitch in the song or something. Like, I'm always looking for like purposeful glitches.
Yeah.
And then the other crazy thing about the production on the hook or the chorus part A is that there's this little like seeping happening at first on every two counts and then on every count and then every half count. And what that is it's the wait tone of a stop sign or a stoplight in Australia. Billy and I were on tour in Australia and we heard like their sound and we thought it was awesome. And then the thing that sounds like it's a hi-hat on like 16th notes in the rest of the hook isn't a hi-hat. It's actually just the crosswalk like go sound in Australia, but I like cut it
seriously
out.
You're giving it like this kind of like almost like a retro 70s disco vibe with that, you know, on the upbeat. It was really cool, but that I didn't realize that totally. Was the sound. That's really cool.
It made us it kept us entertained.
Yeah.
So one question, so you seem to use found sounds quite a bit in your music. I know that you also used one in Break My Heart Again, which was the sound of texting.
Yeah.
What is it about a found sound that makes you want to use it in a song?
Well, you know, I think sounds like to me, it's all about like articulating like the message of the song in a case like Break My Heart Again has like texting sounds because like the premise of that song is that like all the lines in the verses of that song are like literally like text. Me and my ex-girlfriend basically text each other. Crazy, so I wanted to help articulate that. But I think like as far as like match striking and like crosswalk sounds, it's like I just want to have stuff that sounds unique and interesting, you know.
Yeah.
And I think like, you know, I use sample libraries and, you know, sounds that everybody has access to all the time because they're great. But anytime I have like a sound that I find that I'm like, whoa, only I have this sound. even if it's like a crosswalk in Australia where anybody could walk up to that, hear that, it's like only I'm using it, you know? And I think those things are like super exciting to me. And then in the case of like watch from like breaking matches, that's like even better. I'm literally like standing in my bathroom with Billy like striking until the smoke alarm goes off. You know, I think those things
awesome.
It just adds like a level of like
they
add like a depth to the production that like and I think beyond all of those things, there's you could produce a song in 100 million different ways and that can be kind of stressful because you never know if you're making the right decision. And I think anytime there's any sound that feels like it has to be in a song, like it's like, oh my God, well, we have to put that in there. It kind of like relieves me. It makes me feel like I know what I'm doing. You know, I think if you're like just trying out 17 different snare drums or 17 different hi-hats, like it's hard to tell like which one actually is like the right hi-hat and not like the one that you enjoy hearing. But whenever there's like something that's like really just like sounds great in that song, it's like I have to use it.
Yeah. Now, one other thing about the chorus before we move on is that you pull in the, you know, two bars that follow the chorus, you pull the full accompaniments and you really highlight, you know, the I'm a bad guy hook and also the duh. But now what's interesting is that you use them a lot throughout the song. And it's a lot more typical or common to do this production technique in hip hop than it is in pop. You know, pop songs might have, you know, pull the accompaniment totally or just partially just to accentuate the impact of one particular section like the chorus, but you're doing it all over the place, both within and across sections. So I was just wondering, what was your...
You analyze hip all day, but you know why they do that in hip hop so much, right? Because they don't have actual stems. They just have one instrumental file. And so
I see what you're saying.
They can either leave the instrumental file in
or
mute it. And so there's all these stops in hip-hop, and it's literally because they're like, damn, we need a change here. And so they just pull the instrumental out.
which yeah.
is like hilarious, but really effective. I try to like make sure that I'm like learning from stuff like that as much as possible. And, you know, I feel like any focus pulling is like huge for me. And like, to me, like the way that you can make sounds feel really big is to have silence around them. You know,
like
if you listen to like a huge rock song, it doesn't even sound as loud as like a crazy bass drum sound in a song with not a lot in it because there's not enough space for it. So I definitely try to just like leave as much space around everything as possible.
Yeah, I just thought it was great because it was just this other kind of typical quality found in, you know, other kinds of songs, but the way that you implement it is so atypical compared to most other songs that it really provided the song with another unique vibe, which I thought was really cool.
Well, that's awesome. I appreciate it. Thanks for saying that.
So let's see, following the chorus, we get to the post-chorus. And here you hit the listener with what I like to call a triple hook punch. So let's check.
Duh.
So there's the bass hook, which is, you know, also featured in the intro, verse, and chorus. There's the repetition of the stuttered song title hook from the turnaround. And now, most notably, there's now a retro sci-fi-ish lead synth hook. So what led you in that direction to that sci-fi-ish synth hook and also that sound?
I just thought it sounded really spooky and fun. And it added, like, a really new element to a song that, like, needed an out. Like, it didn't have an element like that up until that point. And so I knew that it would be impactful. Mm. And it was a melody that I definitely just like was like whistling or humming and then played on a keyboard after whistling or humming it. And it's kind of a Yiddish melody. Kind of reminds me of like something in Fiddler on the Roof.
Mm.
Overtone.
I was actually thinking like 60s Batman breakout dance kind of stuff, like go-go dancer, you know.
Totally.
But it, you know, it's just like it kind of doesn't belong in the song, but it works so well in the song, you know, and it just takes it to a whole new level in terms of vibe and hookiness.
The thing that it is it's right in the same tonal frequency range as the vocal. It's like a very vocal hook. You know what I mean? It's like,
totally.
That might have even been a melody that we experimented to Philly think. Like, I can't even remember, but it was like, it's very singable, and I knew that it wasn't a vocal part. So that's what it really is. It's like, it's only in that part of the song because there is a vocal in that part of the song, so there's room for it. You know?
And yeah.
It's like, again, it's all about just like space. It's all about like, what can we, because if that was happening at the same time as like the vocal, like you wouldn't know which melody to listen to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. Now, what's also interesting is that instrumental hook post choruses are like really rare in pop. So, you know, most have a vocal hook focus. So did you know that Bad Guy was the only Hot 100 Top 10 hit so far in 2019 to feature an instrumental hook post chorus?
I didn't know that, but it's definitely why I didn't think it would be in the top 10.
Just another atypical quality that sets you apart. So.
Exactly. Cool. Exactly.
So after the post-chorus, you actually hit the listener with another pronounced change-up in the second verse where you initially break it down to just claps and snaps. So let's check that out.
I like it when you take control, even if you know that you don't own me. I'll let you play the role, I'll be your animal. My mommy likes.
So, in addition to shaking things up, I was really wondering if that clap and snap driven breakdown was like intentionally done to provide Billy with like a set point in the song where she can engage the audience in a live setting, you know, get them clapping and singing along.
100,000%. That was the whole goal.
Cool.
We knew without a shadow of a doubt that it was a song that we were going to open our tour and show with this year, because obviously we didn't know it would be a hit. We just knew that we loved it, and so we're going to start every show with the song. And we knew that it was just this amazing clap along moment, and we always wanted a moment like that. And cool. So we just really loved that, like, 1-1-2-1 flat pattern. Loved it.
Yeah. And they totally get into it. So one other thing about the second verse is that it provides another song-defining moment through a really intriguing lyrical twist. So I'm just going to read this one here. So it begins with, "I like it when you take control. Even if you know that you don't own me, I'll let you play the role. I'll be your animal." But then is followed by, "My mommy likes to sing along with me, but she won't sing the song if she reads all the lyrics. She'll pity the men I know." So where did this second stanza come from? You know, it's a complete departure from the song's narrative.
I mean, I think the whole approach to a second verse is to reintroduce the melody of the first verse and to shift the content and then right. to set up the chorus a different way. I think the right. goal of the second verse is to make the chorus sound like a new chorus, even though it's the same chorus. Mm. And all of this was articulated a couple years ago when I wrote a song with the artist Christina Perry of Jar of Art, Human, and all that. I wrote a song with her, and we were working on the second verse. And I was focusing on a rhyme, and she said, "Well, don't forget about the second verse, no rule rule." And that really cracked me up. She was like, there should be no rule in the second verse. And I was like, oh, I love that. And it's always been how I approach second verses, that you should just make them interesting and memorable. And the lyrical content of that is talking about our mom, is that our mom is our biggest supporter and our biggest fan and loves our music. And sometimes we write songs that are not, that do not make us out to be altruistic. We write songs where we are like not great people in the song. And the joke is that if we were singing it to her, she would like sing along and then realize what we're singing about. And then we'd be like, oh, wait. No, it's so reprehensible. So that was kind of a joke. You have to remember that this is the song where in the hook we say might seduce your dad type.
Yep.
Skipping ahead in the song, you know, we get to that outro and where the song just totally flips on its head. So I was just wondering, so usually after such a departure, a song would typically go back to familiar territory, which would, you know, most typically be the chorus. But instead, you keep that heavy, dark trap vibe in effect right through the end, and you never return to the hooky qualities that defined the first three quarters. So for us, you know, the song's ending left us wanting to go back for another listen to hear those hooks again. So did you consider that at all, or did you just really want to end the song on that unsettling note?
I think it was many of those things. You know, Billy and I are always promoting the idea of like less being more, and that you know, instead of making a song 4 minutes long, it's more fun to just listen to a 2 minute song twice. You know, I think in this song specific case, you know, we like it goes back to like her outro hook that she wrote. She says I'm a bad guy like 6 times or something. So it's not like it loses the title of the song or anything. It just kind of reintroduces it in a different way.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we have a tendency to be a little structurally reckless as long as each part of the structure is really interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
well
we're
said.
Not trying to like abandon a part of a song that you want to hear again. We'll definitely give it to you again. But we definitely aren't afraid of just like ending songs before it goes into a middle eight and before it goes into like a final payout for it or a down for it or anything like that. You know, and also this song structure is essentially intro, verse, chorus, part A and B, and then a post chorus, and then verse two, which is like a down verse, and then the hook, chorus A again, and then the post-chorus double, and it introduces that sort of, like, death camp part with, like, the I'm only good at being bad.
And then it goes
to the thing. So a whole song could almost be over there, you know what I mean? Like, if you're comparing it to a song like Old Town Road, I think at that point it's probably, like, it's a two-minute territory, you know? So it definitely could just end there, which I think is, like, another thing that we're always, like, thinking about is like just not having to like, you know, follow any stricture from like, you know, a former era. It's like, you know, Billy and I, this isn't a thing I'm like proud of per se, but like the amount of time I'll like listen to the payoff of the song without listening to the whole song. I do that a lot. I listen to like the first minute of a song I want to hear, and that's enough. You know what I mean? It's like a, like having a couple.
I hear you. Sure.
Totally. That's what Dave does.
Yeah, sure.
Like sometimes you don't need a whole slice of chocolate cake. You just want like 3 bites, and that's like really tasty.
Yeah, totally. But I also love how you have that prolonged silence at the end of that post chorus, which like makes you think, is the song over? And then you just hit him hard, and it's just great. It just works so well.
Thanks, man.
And we love that heavily processed laugh. What inspired that?
Oh, yeah. we have our mics on like all the time, and that laugh is definitely like an authentic laugh. Like, I don't remember what it was that caused, so like, I don't know what cracked her up, but like, we have so many things like that in our songs where she like coughs or something and like cracks us up. And that song, you know what it might be, honestly? Because initially, that intro to the album about like her Invisalign getting taken out was going to be part of Bad Guy. And we laughed a bunch in that. So I might have just taken that laugh or something. But
oh, cool.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought I like pitched it up, like changed the timing of it and made it sound so creepy and weird. And I just loved it because it was so, like the whole song, I just feel like the whole song is like, couldn't be taking itself like less, like it would be such a boring song to listen to if you were listening to a song that was just like, I am so evil and bad and like hardcore. It would just be so boring. And so to me, like the whole song from like lyrics, like tippy toes and like, like that laugh in it stuff. It's like, we wanted it to really be like this kind of like hilarious thing that, you know, it wasn't a joke song at all to us, but it was a funny villain. You know what I mean? I think when I think of like my favorite movies, all the bad guys are really funny.
Oh, totally. Totally. But what I also like about that laugh is that it introduces that section just so well, because you have the song totally flipping on its head. And it's almost like, you know, you're like making fun of the listener, like, oh, were you digging that? Now dig this, you know? So,
exactly.
It was really cool.
So I guess we have one last question for you. What advice can you give aspiring songwriters and producers that want to score that major hit while still remaining true to their own artistic vision?
Yeah, so I'll try to give a sort of a simple, broad answer to that, which would be study all the music that you love really hard. Like, study why you love it and what makes songs that you love great structurally and hook-wise and lyric-wise and tempo-wise. Study them all. Ingest that. Write songs that give you similar feeling of songs that you love, that are inspiring to you. You know, make music that feels a little derivative to you if you feel like it, just to learn how it feels to write a song like that. And then once you've done all that, don't be afraid to ignore all of your own advice and make something that feels like it's a completely different thing and that it might never be a hit because there are no songs on the Billboard Top 10 this year that have instrumental hooks. And then maybe the song is on the Billboard Top 10.
Well said.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Phineas.
Well, thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it. Nice to talk to all of you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.